This is a Federal News Network podcast.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars sponsored by WEPA. Join NITP for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to the January 27th, 2020 For Your Benefit radio show. We're here today with Mark Levine. Mark is an attorney. He's a partner and handler in Levine. He's a good guy. He does a lot of seminars with us. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob.
And I bet we're going to talk about estate planning and something about the new tax law and things like that.
We are going to talk about estate planning. Basically, we're going to talk a lot about leaving assets to your kids and how the SECURE Act is going to change that significantly, at least when it comes to your qualified accounts.
Okay. Could we do a 1,000-mile flyover just for a second? If I'm listening to this and, you know, I know what I do, but I don't know what I don't do, and I go, well, estate planning, I'll get a will drafted, it's a page or two, and that'll be just fine. What do you think about that?
I think that for most people, that's not going to work. I think I spend my life dealing with morbid improbabilities. And so sort of your quote-unquote simple will is all about assuming that nothing will go wrong, that everything will go exactly the way that you expect, and that you know enough to actually know what to expect. And so I think estate planning is really much more about looking at you and your family, looking at all of your different assets. And one of the things we're going to talk about is how some assets act one way and some assets work another way, and making sure that all of those assets and all of that planning is all pointed in the same direction. A lot of people will say to me, I need a will, I don't need an estate plan. But an estate plan is really making sure that your will and your beneficiary designations and your joint assets and your trust are all pointed in the same direction.
Okay, and I think it's good for people to know that this isn't a passing interest of yours. You, your partner, and professional staff have been working with feds close to 100%, not 100%, for a long time.
Yeah, so I think now I'm right at about 20 years of doing seminars, we have an awful lot of people that we work with the federal government. We talk to a lot of people every year at the federal government and probably have represented more feds doing their estate planning than I would imagine anyone has.
And I would also say you cover all pretty much levels.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we cover from sort of basic new families to business owners and family limited partnerships and all sorts of estate planning needs. You never know what's going to walk through your door. You never know what the family has that they have to deal with, whether it's too little or too much, and sort of what all the politics are within the family.
Okay, so talk about family and politics. What are the mechanisms to leave assets to your children if you have children?
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about this morning is focused on how do we leave money to people. I think that for the most part, we're going to focus on kids because there's a lot of intersection between how you do that and the new SECURE Act, and a lot of changes in the way that you can do that with certain assets. So we look at what are the different ways that money passes to people, right? So money passes to people while you're alive. You can make gifts to them. At death, money passes because you've left it to them in a beneficiary designation. Say you're retirement account or your life insurance, you've got a form that says at my death, leave this money to this person. That form overrides your will. So you have a will that says leave money to this person or that person, and certain assets go the way the will says, and certain assets go the way your beneficiary designation says. So if your will says give my Fegley benefit to my husband, but your designation says give it to my brother and sister get it, husband doesn't get it.
Do you come across a percentage of people that were unaware of that? It wasn't that they wanted to take anything away from somebody else, but somebody else in their life became more important than the person that's in the will.
I think we come across a lot of people who just aren't aware of the rule. They aren't aware of that rule. They aren't aware of the fact that joint ownership overrides your will. So if my sister and I own a house, joint with rights of survivorship, at my death, my sister gets that house, even if my will says give it to my wife. So beneficiary designations and joint ownership are a way that people pass an awful lot of assets without really understanding what the rules are. You can leave assets to people that you never realized you were leaving it to, even if your will says do something else.
So in the talks, and you do a lot of these to federal agencies, do you find that people maybe want to change and they change, but they didn't know this, it's called trap, and they were unaware of it, and they say, I didn't know that. What do I do?
Sure. So we get that question a lot. I'll make a statement, you know, the joint ownership overrides your will, the beneficiary designations override your will. And of course, often the immediate response is, so your will is worthless, which it's not, because your will controls everything else. All of those assets that are titled in your name without a beneficiary and without joint ownership. So a lot of people just assume that what you say in your will is what's going to happen. And it's not. You've got to tie those things together. But there are definitely people who are not aware that there are all of these different methods for passing your assets on.
I'd imagine that's especially important, too, in the case of a divorce or a remarriage or a marriage.
Well, it's even more important for federal employees because unlike for non-federal employees or non-federal benefits, a lot of the federal benefits are not voided at divorce, and a separation agreement does not de facto sort of deal with them. You have to take additional steps. So there are a number of states where the simple act of divorce will void a beneficiary designation of life insurance to the divorced spouse. Not true for Fegley. Fegley is going to pay the person listed regardless of the divorce, regardless of the separation agreement, regardless of the divorce decree. TSP. TSP sort of walks like a 401k and it talks like a 401k, but it's not a 401k. And a TSP, your spouse has rights in it while you're working. They have rights in it when you retire. They don't have a right to it at your death. And if you leave it to someone else, including a former spouse, that's the person who will get it.
Interesting you say that. It's not a 401k. For those that maybe aren't aware, 401k is the IRS code section. You may have heard this term, 401, subparagraph K. The TSP has got another one. I think it's four numbers. But they walk and quack kind of sort of like each other, but not in lockstep.
Right. And there are a couple of different things where they're very different. And for the next 2 years, they're very different when it comes to the SECURE Act. They're going to have a different set of rules for the TSP and a different set of rules for a 401k or an IRA over the next 2 years in terms of what happens to them certainly at death.
So the next 2 years, that kind of sort of, the SECURE Act. So it's this period of time from the passage of the Act, let's say 2 years out, that there's kind of a phase in. This one doesn't kick in until the end of 2 years. I think that's called the required minimum distribution. But what about the tweeners that are somewhere between the two?
Yeah, so it's we'll get into, I think, in a couple of minutes more about the SECURE Act itself. But when the SECURE Act was signed into law December 20th, I believe, it became effective January 1st. It did not impact the TSP or other similar federal plans. It did not affect certain state-governed retirement plans, many 403Bs, many 457 plans, and then collectively bargained retirement plans are not affected immediately. So if you have an IRA that you created, that the SECURE Act affects that January 1. If you have a thrift and you die in the next 2 years, the rules that are changing, that have changed, don't change for that account during that two-year period.
So when you've addressed these classes and you say something very much or exactly the same as what you just said to our listeners, do they go, what do I do?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very unclear what we do. And that is something where I think I may have mentioned to someone that I was going to come on and talk about this, and I promised them more questions than answers. Because right now, there's more questions than there are answers about a number of parts of this act. For the people who all they have in terms of retirement accounts are the TSP, that's okay because within the next 2 years, we'll have answers and we'll be able to design plans that more effectively utilize it. For the people with an IRA, we are still in a little bit of unknown territory in terms of not so much the vanilla situations, but certainly some of the situations on the edges that are different. So I think it's probably helpful to talk first about sort of trusts, how we set up trusts for kids or other beneficiaries with qualified accounts up till now, because a lot of people are familiar with what's known as the stretch IRA, where you leave your IRA to your child and they can use their life expectancy to take the money out. So practically speaking, what does that mean? You have a $300,000 TSP and you left that to your 25-year-old child. They have to move that TSP into what's called an inherited IRA, not their own IRA, but a new inherited IRA. And they then have to start taking minimum required distributions every year over the rest of their expected lifetime. So the 25-year-old has a 50-year life expectancy, let's say. So they have to take out a very small piece at age 26. They pay income tax on that piece based on their income tax rate, and the rest of it continues to grow tax deferred every year. So actually for many, many years, your 25-year-old is going to earn more, have more growth in their inherited IRA than they have to take money out. And so it actually can grow significantly over the years. So what IRS, what they changed in the new law is to say, okay, now when you leave your account to your 25-year-old, they only have 10 years to take the money out. So between the date of death and 10 years from the date of death, they're required to have taken everything out of that inherited IRA, and they're required to pay all the income taxes within that 10-year period.
Now, could to the extreme, clearly they could take it all out the first day and pay the taxes on it. Let's go to the other extreme. I don't want to touch it because the investment will earn me less because I'm paying taxes on it. Could I wait till the end of the 10th year to take it all out?
Yeah, so what's interesting about the new law is that unlike the required minimum distribution, which was a distribution every year, it just all has to be out by the end of 10 years. So you could take out 4% the first year and 28% the second year and 35% the next year and then not take out another penny until year 10 when you take it all out. But what you're going to have to manage there, and I think this is going to fall a lot on CPAs and financial advisors, is the income tax burden. Because whatever you take out during that 10 years, that is income, ordinary income to the person who takes it out. And so managing that income tax burden, I think, is going to become a huge part of year-end planning for financial advisors and accountants. When do we take it out? Does it make sense this year? Was our rate lower? How much should we take out? Because if we take out more than X, it's going to bump us to another rate, another tax rate. And so happily for the estate planning attorneys, a lot of that work falls on you, accountants and financial advisors, to sort of figure out when in that 10 years is it best to take the money out.
Okay, now you said something was spot on, that the money coming out of these investments would be taxed as regular old income. So it would not get the special tax treatment that a dividend in a mutual fund would pay or a stock. And it wouldn't get what they call a long-term capital gain if it's held a certain period of time. I'm not trying to drive people crazy, but there's one thing that will happen. You don't need to worry about that because coming out of here, it's just regular old income.
That's right. And so that management is going to be difficult, I think, as time goes on. It becomes more difficult than when we apply control to that. What is it we're trying to do to control those assets? But the first part of it is really that balance of when do we take it out? Because sort of your gut, and I think your gut was, well, we want to defer that as long as possible because we want to get as much deferred growth. Except come year 10, all of that is income. And so if year 10, you could get popped to the highest tax rate and pay a higher amount, whereas if you took a little bit out each year, you're going to stay at a lower tax rate. And then what's the delta between that? Is it how much growth do you get versus, you know, how much more tax do you pay paying at a higher income tax rate?
So I think it's time to take a break. We'll listen to what WAPA, the sponsor of the show, can do for our listeners. And also, we can regroup a little bit. What you just talked about was very good, but 10 years is a new ball game. It's not a long period of time. Anyway, we'll be back right after the break.
WAPA is a proud sponsor of For Your Benefit, presented by NITP Mondays 10:05 to 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. Federal open season is over, but there's never been a better time to reevaluate your life insurance coverage. Get life insurance for less with WAPA. WEPA has been ensuring the future of federal employees for more than 75 years. WEPA can be used as a supplement or replacement for your existing policy and costs up to 89% less than Fegley. In fact, last year, members who switched saved $375 on average. Although open season is over, you can apply anytime for WEPA Group Term Life Insurance. See how much you could save by visiting WAEPA.org today.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here January 27th, 2020. We're talking with Mark Levine, attorney at law, well-versed in the federal sector, probably teaches a seminar a few times a week, retirement seminars.
About once a week, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And it would be all around certainly D.C., and occasionally you go outside of D.C.
Occasionally.
All righty. So I think we got the basics, and hopefully everybody tracked with and there's a new ball game with regards to distributions, the length thereof, and the like. So where do we go next?
I think it's a good idea just to step back for a minute and explain what the SECURE Act is. So the SECURE Act is a whole suite of changes to retirement benefits. Many of them have nothing to do with estate planning at all. Many of them have to do with the structure of retirement plans, when you can start taking or when you have to start taking required minimum distributions, which is now 72 rather than 70 and a half. And it had these changes in how money is paid out. So the rule currently under the SECURE Act is that at death, if your retirement account, and let's fast forward 2 years and assume this applies to everyone, including the federal workers, goes to your spouse, there are no changes. Your spouse still has all of the options they had before the SECURE Act. If it goes to a non-spouse, there's actually now a bunch of different categories we have to look at. There is the minor child of the decedent. So if grandma leaves an IRA to granddaughter, doesn't apply. It only applies if you leave it to your child. So I can leave money to my minor child, and we still use that lifetime stretch. We still get to say, if I have a two-year-old, that money only has to come out of that account based on their life expectancy, which is a very, very long time. But that ends at the age of majority. So that could be 18, it could be 21, it could be later in some circumstances. We haven't received all the information on that. And then the 10 years starts. So let's talk about a typical child. They're 4 years old. So parents pass away and money goes into this trust. So from 4 to 18, it's a trust where you get to only take out a small, tiny bit every year, pay income tax on that small, tiny bit at that child's rate, and the rest of it continues to grow tax deferred. So it's that same great deferred income tax investment we had before.
If there was an emergency, a medical emergency with the child, or they needed special care, could the distribution be accelerated?
Usually. In other words, let's assume this is paid into a trust that's designed for this. The trustee would be allowed to take more money out, pay more income taxes to do the thing that needed to be done. But now under the SECURE Act, when that child reaches 18, let's assume it's a very vanilla case and 18 is the age of majority, when they turn 18, that converts into a 10-year payout. That says, okay, now you've got to take all the money out of this inherited IRA between now and the end of the next 10 years. So in a vanilla case, that's going to be 28. 28 is going to be the new magic age when you have to decide, am I comfortable with my kid getting all of this money outright 100% to do anything they want to do with it? That is a decision that I will tell you among my clients varies enormously. I have clients who don't understand why I don't think their 18-year-old should get everything outright. And I have clients who don't understand why their 50-year-old should get anything at all or don't believe that would be a good idea for them at all. And so that difference of, it accelerates as soon as they reach their majority is going to become a significant issue in the planning. Whether or not we're willing to give the child control of that money earlier than we might want to get income tax savings. And we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The other big change is that lifetime exemption, that lifetime payout, the stretch, is still available for children with chronic illnesses or under a disability. And so you can still have a special needs trust, for example, that will stretch out the child's IRA payments over their lifetime. So it actually made it easier to do those trusts, not harder. And so for parents who have children with special needs, the urgency of making a change or doing something is not going to be as great. We still want to look at the trust, and there's still some things that we can change and actually make easier. But it's not going to be the same urgency because their trust for their child is still going to be able to use that lifetime exemption.
Is there a good definition of what special needs are, is?
Not in the Act.
Yeah.
So we assume that the Act is using definitions from elsewhere in the code. And so there are some things that we can sort of go out and look at and say, okay, well, they must mean this. But the SECURE Act itself didn't provide us with definitions. It provided us with sort of references to other places to get definitions. So those are things that, you know, we think we understand what they mean, but ultimately there are going to be regulations and rulings and other things that are going to come out that are going to help us be sure that we know what they're talking about.
So when somebody's having their will written or rewritten, they need to at least have some idea that there's things outside of what it used to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that anyone with special needs children
mm-hmm.
needs to be using a lawyer. You know, we're not going to get into this morning the usefulness of programs or of online things or things like that, but they exist. Certainly, if you have a child with special needs, a child who is going to have any sort of receive any benefit, any means-tested benefit at all, you have to use a lawyer who knows what they're doing for that stuff because it's just too technical and even more technical now than it used to be.
I usually don't do this. This is going to sound self-serving for you, but you do know this stuff. So how would somebody get in touch with you or a website?
Sure. So our website's handlerlevine.com, www.handlerlevine.com. My email is Mark, M-A-R-C, @ handlerlevine.com, handlerlevine.com. And the phone number is 301-961-6464.
Thank you. I usually wake up with about 2 minutes to go before the show ends and ask that. But as you were talking, I go, you know, this is a good time.
I think that's true.
Okay. So back to the analysis.
So the other thing with the SECURE Act is when it goes to someone who is not younger than 10 years, that's another exception. They can use a lifetime stretch as well. So I think that, you know, understanding that things have changed, you then have to look back at what did you do and why did you do it. A lot of times when we're doing estate planning with clients, and we talk about this in class a lot of our conversations are this tension between control and efficiency. And what's more important to you? What is it that you're trying to accomplish? Do you want to be as efficient as possible, but not have any control? Or do you want to have control? And if so, how much efficiency are you willing to give up? There's all sorts of different kinds of efficiency. There's administrative efficiency, right? Just having a trust at all is inefficient. You have somebody who's in control of money for somebody else. That's not as efficient as me being in control of my own money. So you lose efficiency there. You may have efficiency issues where you have a guardian and a different person's a trustee and you have a minor child and now you've got yet another person involved in that and more inefficiency. And when we're talking about retirement accounts, though, one of the big inefficiencies we're talking about are taxes. Remember that this money, no one has ever paid tax on. If you have a $250,000 TSP, no one's ever paid income tax on that money. And it's always been the case that someday, somewhere, someone was going to have to pay that income tax. If you weren't leaving your TSP to a charity, then somebody sooner or later was going to pay income tax on that money. And the difference was that someone somewhere could be a great-grandchild ultimately ending that account 100 years from now. Now we know that's not going to happen. It's never going to last that long. The taxes are going to have to get paid much, much earlier. And again, this is money that no one's ever paid tax on. So it's, you know, the argument about the estate tax or an inheritance tax or even capital gains taxes doesn't really apply philosophically. This is the first time this money will be taxed.
When you teach the classes, do people say, boy, I've always wanted a Roth, but it seems now I should want one more than I've had before?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of the things that are going to come up here are, should I be making a conversion to a Roth earlier? And, you know, I've always been very reticent. I don't ever say in your particular case you should or shouldn't. That's the financial advisor's job. That's your job. But I'll say, you know, these are questions to ask or things to look at. I don't like the sort of the at death tail wagging the life dog. So you really need to look at, you know, how does this impact me during my life today if I make this conversion in terms of how much money I have and how much I have to come up with to pay the tax, things like that, versus, okay, but when I'm gone, this is what it will mean for my kids. And, you know, I think it's really important to not ignore the fact that you have to live and probably for decades will have to live with the impact of having made that Roth conversion decision.
Right. And on the other side, when looking at the distribution of the assets, not everybody does this, but the distribution app would normally go to family first, I'd imagine. But then there might be some that the person really has a desire to leave to a charity. So working with that, maybe it's looking, okay, the charity gets the fully taxable asset and the other ones get the less than fully taxable.
Yeah, that is very often a light bulb moment for clients before this ever came up. In other words, where they said, well, I want to leave, you know, this much money to my church and I want to leave this much money to my kids. And so they're leaving the life insurance to the church and the, you know, TSP to the kids. And we say, well, let's look at changing that, because if the TSP goes to the church, there's no income taxes paid ever. How old are the kids? When would they take the money out? Now, especially where we know they're going to be taxed on it no later, if they're adults, 10 years from when you die, you know, there's a very strong argument to be made that instead, if you have a charitable intent, that it makes sense to put the money into the charity now from the, I mean, at your death from the TSP, rather than having that go to the kids. The issue really, I mean, a lot of this efficiency versus control issues comes when we talk about trusts for kids. So I have a 14-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 19-year-old. They are wonderful people. I love them. I think they're all going to be really good human beings. But I have a trust that goes considerably into their future, because I am worried that if sort of the worst thing that could happen happens and my wife and I are both gone, how's that going to affect my kids? Who are they going to be at 24 or 30, et cetera? So I have a trust set up that says, hey, take my money. If my wife and I are both gone, put it into this trust. Here are the guidelines that I want my guardian, my trustee to use when they use the money for my kids. And we go into some detail about that. And so this way the money's there. It's there to help them, but it's not there so that there's ever money where they could say, hey, I don't have to work or I don't have to go to school. I mean, truthfully, I couldn't leave them enough money to not have to work or go to school. But you can't tell a 20-year-old that. You know, to them, $300,000 may seem like all the money they'll ever need. And so I have a trust that says, okay, you know, the trustee is going to take care of your health and your education and your maintenance and support and give you other money based on certain things. That's easy to do with a life insurance policy. I have $1 million life insurance policy. I put it into three trusts for my kids. No problem. It's always been much more difficult to deal with your IRA that way. Because I have $1 million IRA, that money going in there, there's all of those unpaid taxes. And we used to be able to do these neat things called, you know, conduit and accumulation trusts, where we could control the money for the kid's lifetime, but stretch it out over their lifetime so that they had access to it, but we didn't have to pay the taxes right away. Now what IRS says is you're not going to be able to do that. You can't do that anymore. You're not going to get that lifetime stretch in a vanilla, you know, child situation, you're going to have to make some hard choices. And the choices are harder than just, am I comfortable with my kid getting it after 10 years? Because you kind of have to decide, am I creating a trust where I control the money? If so, that's probably going to be a sort of what we'll call a five-year trust, where the taxes from the IRA have to be paid within 5 years. But if you do that, if you pay all the money within the 5 years, you get to control the money for the kid's life. You don't ever have to worry about the IRS says we have to distribute money directly to the child, we can control it. We can decide when they get it and how they use it. Maybe they don't get it. Maybe they only get it for these certain reasons that I think are good reasons. You get to control when and how they get the money. But all those taxes are all paid at the usually highest possible rate within 5 years.
Okay, but the trust is spending the dollars to pay the tax.
Sure, that's
so
right.
So it's reducing, you know, so I understand this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it reduces the liquid assets, if you will, of the trust.
That's right. So you had $1 million IRA, you pay all the taxes, you've got a $600,000 IRA.
Okay.
It's not quite as stark as that because you're going to get some 5 years of growth that are some of it's tax deferred, but let's assume for a moment that's what you've got to pay. You've got to pay that 30, 35, 40% of taxes in order to control what's left. The problem is that other trusts that the other rules we've been talking about, those 10 years, at the end of the 10 years, in order to get that 10 years of distributions, that stretch, the money has to go to the kid at the end of 10 years. So what we can't say is, I've got a 14-year-old, I'm going to have my one set of rules from 14 to 18, one set of rules from 18 to 28, and then I can still control the money. We just have to pay the tax on it. No. But IRS says at the end of that 28, you know, age, you've got to give the money to her. You can't control it. You can't have it in a trust. It is hers. If you want to control it past that age 28 year, you're going to have a different kind of trust where all the taxes are paid within 5 years. So this is where we talk about that sort of very stark question. What am I willing to do? How much control do I need? And which children and which assets for the next 2 years does that apply to? And that's where we have to start looking really hard at who people are and what your goals are for these kids and where the assets are coming from. What is it you want to leave them?
So for those that maybe missed the first few minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes of the show and the like, and they're hearing this thing about 10 years, the old law that it can be taken out over a significant period of time is no longer in existence.
For most people. So look, when we talk about this, we're really focused on what most people listening to this, which most federal employees are going to have to deal with. There are exceptions to these rules. There are some very, very smart people who are looking at some very interesting ways to sort of deal with some of these issues. But honestly, most of those ways aren't going to apply to most of us. Most of us who have a sort of regular size estate and a regular size retirement account, we're not going to be looking at some of these more esoteric ways to make these changes or to get around the system. We're going to be dealing within the system. And sort of within the system, we've got some stark choices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you have to look at is if I have that $1 million, and this is a conversation we have with clients all the time about life insurance. And they'll say, well, I don't really need life insurance. I have my TSP. And I say, well, that's great. And you've done very well in your TSP, and it's a great asset. But if you have to use it quickly and use a lot of it, what's it going to cost you to do that? $1 million TSP that has to be used quickly is not $1 million, because every time you take money out of it, you've got to pay income tax on it. And the more you take out, the more your income tax rate's going to go up.
And the balance goes down.
The balance goes down.
Yeah.
So $1 million TSP that you have to use quickly because your spouse passed away and suddenly you need money to do things, it's not really $1 million. $1 million life insurance policy is still $1 million. And so even before this, you know, we would talk about, you know, the concept of self-insuring, especially for people with younger kids. Your TSP is not an insurance policy. It is, your IRA is not, your 403B is not, your 401K is not. All of those qualified plans, they all have these tax issues attached to them about, you know, do I have to use it? And if I use it, how much am I going to pay in taxes?
This is a perfect time to take the second break and listen to what NITP can do for the listeners. We provide retirement seminars, mid-career seminars at a huge percentage of the federal government. So again, this is not a commercial because these courses are put on by the agency and paid by the agency. Anyway, let's listen.
Who do you trust when making your most important decisions? National Institute of Transition Planning has been the trusted source for federal retirement planning, serving new, mid-career, and pre-retirement federal employees for more than 30 years. NITP's subject matter experts bring more than 800 years of collective expertise on federal benefits, financial transition, and estate planning. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com to sign up for their free monthly newsletter and information about free webinars.
Does planning for retirement seem like a daunting task? Is retirement years away? It will arrive sooner than you think. Prepare now to stay on track. Join the thousands of federal employees and retirees who have already attended National Institute of Transition Planning's free monthly webinars to learn more about retirement and financial planning. NITP is the national leader and trusted source for federal retirement information. Visit NITPinc.com to sign up for NITP's free monthly newsletter and webinar.
Welcome back to For Your Benefit. We're here today with Mark Levine, attorney of law with Handler & Levine, knower of all things federal, tax, and anything else you want to ask. Anyway, Mark, right before the break, we were talking, if I'm not mistaken, about life insurance in general. And of course, WEPA is the sponsor of the show, and NITP provides the seminars. And let's remember that, folks. But Mark, your velvet tones once again, please.
Well, I think one of the things we were talking about, again, this control versus efficiency and your intent. What do you want to leave your kids? What is it important to you as a philosophical matter? What is it important to you as a support matter? In other words, you've got little kids and you have to make sure there's money to raise them. There's money to provide for a spouse, perhaps to work differently or work less because you're gone. And I think that these new rules are probably going to put a premium on sort of looking at life insurance as a hedge against these taxes. So if you know that you want to leave your kids a certain amount of money and you don't want these new tax rules to eat into the amount of the retirement or the total amount that they're going to get, but you still want control, one of the things you can do is use that sort of five-year trust where it's sort of a complete control trust. You've got a six-year-old and you don't know who they are, or you have a 20-year-old and you're very concerned about who they are, or a 26-year-old and you know who they are and that there are problems or issues. You may want to control the money. And one of the ways to do that is go ahead and use the sort of the control trust that will mean that taxes are paid much, much sooner. But add in some life insurance. Add some life insurance that will get that total back up to where you want it to be to take care of that child or that family member in the way that you were intending. So that's where we sort of are looking at the most control is the least tax efficient. And that's always been true, but we don't have an in-between place now the way we used to, where we could have a little of both.
Could grandparents be faced with the same decisions, assuming the parents are okay with this, as to who inherits what from grandma and granddad's estate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's sort of the same issues. Control and efficiency always become an issue, right? So grandparents will sometimes say, well, my kids are okay. They don't need it. I'll give it to my grandkids. Okay. But again, you may lose the ability, if the kids need it, to use it for them. And so for most people, it's sort of a straight line. I'm going to leave it to my kids. I'll let my kids worry about how it gets to my grandkids. But they'll usually say, look, if something happens to my kid, if my kid and I are both in the car together and something happens, then I have to say what happens with my grandkid. And so, again, you look at what does that trust look like? Grandchildren don't get that lifetime stretch time period from, you know, birth to 18. They had an immediate 10-year rule. So if you end up leaving your IRA to a six-year-old, your six-year-old grandchild, all of the money has to come out of that when they turn 16. So again, those control issues just pop right back up. How do we do that? And the obvious thing that we do is we create a trust. We've got a six-year-old. The money may end up with a six-year-old. Obviously, our first thought is we want to leave it in a trust for them. The second thought is, okay, great. We've got the trust. We've got the trust terms that we want. We have the assets pouring in there. We've said, all right, we've created this trust, and we've changed the beneficiary designations so that the TSP is going to pour into that child's trust, The second thing we have to look at then is, what's the tax impact? When would they get the money if we want to make it tax efficient? When would they get the money if we want control but no tax efficiency? And those questions just become more and more pointed because, again, people are just going to have to make stark choices about what they're trying to accomplish with their estate planning, that we used to be able to make a nice meeting in the middle of giving up some efficiency and some control. Now, it, again, that very stark decision, and I do think life insurance in a lot of situations is going to come in to sort of fill that gap.
10-year rule is interesting to me because it's going to be very tailored to the individual that, well, I can wait 10 years. My tax bracket maybe is going to be a lot higher. I hope it is, but probably it's not. So I could wait or take out something every 2 or 3 years. And there might be some efficiency there. I'm not telling people that they should do that, but they should look at that.
Well, I'll tell people that they are absolutely, if they inherit an IRA, for example, going on from here, every year are going to need to talk with their accountant and financial advisor about, okay, you know, what's the plan for this year? And what's the plan for the next 10 years and 9 years and 8 years and 7 years? And then that plan's, I think, going to get revised every year based on what their salary looks like going forward, what the tax rates look like going forward. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty and a lot of revisions for that.
And have you had people come in? The law has not been around
that long.
Right,
it's early days. So, you know, there's nothing there. The other place it's going to be a lot of issues is for trustees, because trustees are going to be faced with those decisions, but instead of having to make that for themselves, they're going to have to make it for the beneficiary. They're going to have to say, do we want to distribute money to this beneficiary now outright because we'll get a lower tax rate? Do we want to wait and do it later on down the line because we're too concerned? And they're going to be faced with some real fiduciary issues about keeping the taxes sort of controllable over that 10-year period, but still controlling for sort of the beneficial good of the child, of the beneficiary.
Does this get tougher if, let's say, there's more than one child, but the age difference is not extreme, but there might be 4 years between this and that, and there might be 10 years between?
Look, if the trust is structured properly for those sorts of situations, you're going to have a situation where they're separate accounts, separate trusts, but it's not really an issue of the oldest beneficiary anymore. Because of the 10-year rule, it's 10 years for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got a 26-year-old and a 22-year-old and a 16-year-old. It's the same 10 years from the date of your death. So it doesn't really matter, except with the 16-year-old, their 10 years doesn't start till they're 18.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not going to change anymore. It's going to change your questions about the kids. And we certainly have situations where mom and dad think the 27-year-old could handle the money tomorrow. They, you know, whatever's the most tax-efficient thing, do that. But they've got a 22-year-old who they have real questions about and real concerns about and may end up treating differently than the 27-year-old. I think that sort of fair versus equal conversation is a very hard one for parents as kids get older. It's very easy to treat our, you know, 2-year-old, 5-year-old, and 7-year-old exactly the same because we don't know who any of them are going to be. But you've got a 29-year-old and a 27-year-old and a 24-year-old. You may look at them and you know, you may think your 29 and 24-year-olds are fine, but you may have real concerns about your 27-year-old and how you're going to treat them differently. What kind of trust will they have and what choices are we making for them? And now those choices have very, very real income tax differences.
Well, what the folks that you have talked to, what was their initial, do you remember one in particular, they had an adverse reaction to this?
I don't know of anyone who's had a positive reaction to this. I think that, again, because we're in such early days of this, most of it is still conversation. You know, most of it is, okay, here's the new playing field, and here are your new things that you've got to think about in terms of, you know, your decision-making process and what's important to you. And again, the people who are younger and know less about their kids are generally going to emphasize control over efficiency. And you hope as your kids get older, you will start to switch that, that you will start to emphasize efficiency over control. And, you know, even then for adult children, that the delta is not what it was, right? So if you have a 24-year-old and you want a five-year trust, they pay the taxes, you know, when by the time they're 29 or the trust does. If you wanted the 10-year rule, then, you know, it's only five more years of tax deferral. It really becomes very stark, though, when we're talking about young kids. Because with a two-year-old, well, we're talking about 26 years of some sort of tax deferral versus 5 years of tax deferral. And so it's a very real income tax dilemma for parents of young children. What do I emphasize? Do I emphasize the control or the efficiency? And there's going to be a real significant difference between those two numbers, I think.
You talk to groups and you're educating the groups, but not everybody's fortunate enough to have somebody like you come in and talk to the employees of the group. So they might miss the train somewhat here. And are there readings somebody could read about this? Are there articles?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of people. If you are very technically minded, a woman named Natalie Choate, C-H-O-A-T-E. Writes on this stuff and talks about this stuff and knows more very often than the people who write the materials. And then there's a website, Kitsis, KITCES.com, a guy, Michael Kitsis, another guy, Jeffrey, I assume Levine, because that's how I would pronounce my name, write on this subject as well. And I find that they write in a way that is very as easily digestible as you are likely to find. I was about to say easy to understand, but I'm not sure any of the stuff is that easy to understand. But I think that they do a good job of it.
Well, they slice and dice it, as they say, and they don't take you to the hoop at the beginning. I mean, so the tougher part is usually midway or in my readings, and I really enjoy it.
Right. I think, look, if you're a federal employee and you and your spouse, all you have is the thrift, the good news is you're going to be, by the time this impacts you, we're all going to be better educated. We're all going to be better used to doing it. We're going to know what IRS means by some of the words that we don't know what they mean right now, or at least we suspect what they mean, but we want to be sure. So you've got a little bit of time, quite frankly, that other people don't. On the other hand, if you're a Fed and your spouse is not, and they have an IRA, you know, then you all are operating under two different sets of rules for the next 2 years. And it's going to create, you know, again, more choices for you. Do we deal with this now as though, you know, it's 2 years from now, or do we deal with part of it now and part of it later? They didn't make anything easier at all with this part of it. They just made it more difficult.
You and I do a lot of talks to, again, government groups. And we're different in what we talk about, but similar in the end. Have you seen any reaction from the class when you talk about some of this and they go, what?
Well, I mean, honestly, that's kind of the reaction you get when you talked about the old rule, which is, you know, this is not something that is apparent to most people. They look at their TSP and they think that's money. And when that money goes to my kids, you know, I've got life insurance that goes, I have equity in my house, I have my TSP. And the fact that you've got to figure out this income tax issue, that always flummoxes people. It flummoxes a lot of lawyers. I mean, you know, the takeaway I will say is now more than ever, when your attorney says your TSP is going into a trust, you've got to make sure that you understand the consequences of that and the attorney understands the consequence of that. How that's going to go to them, when it's going to go to them, who's going to be in charge of it, and most importantly, what are the taxes? How much is going to be left after that tax bite is taken, and how do we plan for that? Is that enough? Is that part of our plan, or do we need to look at other options?
Very good. All right. So we have 2.5 minutes, Andrew, 3 minutes. We've got all the time.
All the time in the world.
Final thoughts?
Well, I think that, again, there are different ways that assets pass. And, you know, we deal with clients who – all of our clients have beneficiary designations. And I think it's really important to remember your beneficiary designations are estate planning documents. They're as important to you as your will or trust. And now more so than ever, focusing on the assets that pass. So a beneficiary designation for a life insurance policy, a payable on death for a bank account or a brokerage account need to be tied into your estate plan. If you're leaving money to your kids or your spouse or your brother in a trust, the trust needs to be the beneficiary. And if it's a retirement account, if it's a qualified account, if it's any account where you have not paid taxes on it going in or aren't paying taxes on it now, you need to make sure you have that conversation with the attorney about what is that impact? How does that impact what my kids can actually do down the road?
What are surprises, adverse reactions when you explain this? And this is un-American. How can they do this?
Well, you know, it's interesting because philosophically, I think it's much more understandable than a lot of other tax rules. Our IRAs, 401ks, et cetera, were designed to help us retire. They weren't necessarily designed to help our children and grandchildren retire. And so taxing this money sometime before, you know, 50 years from now, some of it, is not that philosophically insulting. I think people have a much bigger impact to estate and inheritance taxes feeling like that's double taxation. This is really, you're just getting taxed on this money, and it was a gift that you got to get taxed on it later than you would have normally.
Well, this has been a gift from you to the listeners. And Andrew, as we have less than a minute, but one more time, what's your contact point?
Sure. It's Mark, M-A-R-C, at HandlerLevine.com, HandlerLevine.com. And HandlerLevine.com is the website. Again, HandlerLevine.com.
And you've been doing this for a while.
We do is estate planning, probate, and trust administration. So that's all the attorneys at the firm do is focus on this sort of thing. And we focus on it for an awful lot of federal employees.
I think one of the better days of my life is when I met your partner.
Mine too.
It was a long time ago, but he was masterful in a business settlement and hasn't changed a bit since.
Yep.
Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back next week, and you should listen to this. Maybe go back, rewind, and listen to it again. I will. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP and sponsored by WEPA. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. This show can also be heard on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search For Your Benefit. Thanks for listening.